Okay, so this afternoon, our discourse of choice is the Mahasihanada Sutta, the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar. And unfortunately, like last week, I don't have the essay by Venerable Inalio to help guide us through the... actually, this one, I've got an extra Majjhima here if somebody wants another copy of the Majjhima. Don't have a copy of the essay by Venerable Inalio. Tama, have you had a chance to look at the Chinese versions?
I got some information about comparative.
Uh-huh. Okay. You didn't have too many details.
Check, because this time has six different sutras.
Six different ones. Well, can I have a look? In what? Oh, there you go. There you go.
Maybe I just read it for you. Sutra,
yeah, go on. Read it, go on.
It's two individual sutras. It's one sutra means that very happy, so all the hair thinner.
Oh yeah, hair raising discourse.
Yeah. And this is the individual one. And the other individual sutra, the name in Chinese is To Realize Different Power Sutra.
Mm-hmm.
In Taisho 17.
Mm-hmm.
And then one is in Anguta Agama 42, the other one is Anguta Agama 48, Anguta Agama 23, and Sanyuta Agama 54,
46. Seems unusual that there's three corresponding suttas in the Ekotra Agama.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Ekotra.
Yeah. You said Anguttara, and then it's Chinese is Ekotara.
Okay.
Yeah?
Ekotara.
Yeah. There's three parallel suttas there.
Uh-huh.
Which is a bit unusual, isn't it?
Mm.
So, obviously a bit of a popular sutta. One which is,
164.
One which is repeated many times, throughout the canons. Okay, so this discourse is one of a class of suttas or a set of suttas which are about a lion's roar, and of course the lion's roar being something which is a magnificent and powerful declaration of strength. And so the Buddha from time to time would roar his lion's roar, or perhaps some of the disciples would roar their lion's roar, the Sihanada. And of course in ancient India, they still had lions, unlike today when by now all the lions have disappeared from India, which demonstrates that as much as we might fear the wild beasts have a lot more to fear from us than we do from them. There's this very wonderful sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya when it talks about this, and it said when the lion, the king of beasts, he comes out of its lair, stretches himself, yawns, and then roars three times, and basically all the animals and everything around completely freak out and run in every direction, and even the elephants which are tied up in the village will break their bonds and run around trumpeting madly and defecating and urinating everywhere out of their fear and terror for the strength and power of the lion. So you've got to imagine like how powerful it was in those days. You know, for us, it's all very easy for us to sit down and we don't take it very seriously anymore. In fact, just trying to get hold of I wanted to get the MGM logo where it has the roaring lion, yeah? And actually roaring, it's a great roar. But what was interesting is when I tried to look for it on YouTube to find that logo, I couldn't find the actual one. All I could find is these various parodies of one. So, you know, you get a hamster or something like that and put that in there and have the hamster roaring instead of the lion or something like that. And so we can't take it seriously anymore. We don't take the lion's roaring seriously. Yeah? All we can do is joke about it. But in those days, it was deadly serious, absolutely serious. And anthropologists have, or archaeologists have found that a very large proportion of human skulls from the old days of the cavemen era have the skulls pierced or broken with a very large cat tooth, And it was, seems that it was one of the major predators in those days, possibly the saber-toothed tiger. And some people even go so far as to suggest that the saber-toothed tiger or closely related animal was the root monster or the fundamental monster which haunts our dreams. And that our human image of what it means to be a monster is derived from this idea of the big cat. So when the Buddha is roaring this lion's roar, he's making this kind of very kingly, very uncontrovertible statement. Now in this particular sutta, the Mahasayanata Sutta, the Majjhima 12, he is roaring this roar in respect of the statement made by a certain Sunakata. Now Sunakata, the word Sunakata means lucky star. Okay, but unfortunately, he doesn't actually seem to have been all that lucky. Certainly not in his Buddhist career. I've got a bit of a blurb here about Sunakata. This is from the Dictionary of Pali. Proper names: Sunakata was a Lichavi prince of Vesali. He is at one time a member of the Sangha and the personal attendant of the Buddha, but was later converted to the views of Korakatiya, and went around defaming the Buddha, saying he had nothing superhuman and was not distinguished from other men by preaching a saving faith, that the doctrine preached by him did not lead to the destruction of sorrow, etc. Sariputta, on his arms around Vesali, heard all this and reported it to the Buddha, who thereupon preached the Mahasayanata Sutta. And according to the commentary, the Buddha at this time of teaching this sutta was 80 years old. And he also at this time taught the Lomahansa Jataka. And sister, you mentioned that one of the Chinese translations was called the hair-raising discourse. So this is what Lomahansa means. So the Jataka that's associated with this story is called the hair-raising Jataka. The Sunakata Sutta was evidently preached to Sunakata before he joined the order. So this is another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And that's in Majjhima, I've got it here, Majjhima 105. Was evidently taught before he joined the Sangha, while the Patika Sutta in the Digha Nikaya gives an account of his dissatisfaction. Okay. His grievance was that the Buddha showed no mystic superhuman wonders and that he had not shown him the beginning of things. The Buddha reminded him that he had not promised to do any of these things, and that at one time Sunakata had been loud in his praise of the Buddha and the Dhamma. The Buddha warned him that people would say he left the order because its discipline had proved too harsh for him. The Buddha had told him that Korakatiya, who he so much admired, would be born after death among the Kala Kanjaka Asuras within 7 days. Of course, it all happened as the Buddha prophesied, and the dead body of Kora declared that he was right. Even so, Sunakata was not convinced. So that refers to the events in the Patika Sutta, and yes, you're quite right that the dead body of Kora came back to life in order to announce his state of rebirth. So this being the one and only time in the Buddhist scriptures where a dead body is supposed to have come, actually reanimated itself.
You understand
that? Is that?
What
is
that?
What happened in the vineyard?
They came and took the cloth from the dead body,
mm-hmm.
And then the dead body came back alive and changed
mind. Is that the dead body or was that the ghost of it?
I can't remember if it's the ghost of the dead
body. I thought that was the ghost.
The ghost
I think that was the ghost. This one's the actual body. The actual rotting, fleshy bit of meat which is lying there on the charnel ground. Later, he transferred his allegiance to Kandarasamasaka, who died as the Buddha prophesied, fallen from grace and fame. The next teacher to win the admiration of Sunakata was Patikaputta. And Sunakata wished the Buddha to pay honour to him, but the Buddha quoted to Sunakata the words of Ajita, the Lichavi general who had been reborn in Tavatimsa, to the effect that Patikaputta was a liar and a cheat. And the Buddha was later able to prove that these words were in fact true. But Sunakata did not return to the order. He probably remained as a monk for several years before actually leaving it. For we find in the Mahali Sutta that the Lichavi Ottadha, relating to the Buddha how Sunakata had come to him 3 years after joining the order, claiming that he could see divine forms but could not hear heavenly sounds. Buddha Gosu explains that he could not acquire the power of hearing divine sounds because in a previous birth he had ruptured the eardrum of a holy monk and made him deaf. However, the sutta itself gives as the reason that he'd only developed one-sided concentration of mind. So Sunakata is also identified with Kanarita of the Bhuridatta Jataka. So we have quite a few texts relating to Sunakata and his somewhat dismal spiritual career. In the Sunakata Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, he comes... he seems to have been obsessed with this notion of who's actually enlightened and who's got real attainments. His first discourse that he's involved in, the Sunakata Sutta, he hears, oh, many of these bhikkhus are declaring that they've become an arahants, and he goes to the Buddha and says, well, is this true or is this not? Are all the bhikkhus who claim to be arahants really arahants, or are they not really arahants? And the Buddha replied, well, there were some who were, and there were some who not. So when they declare their arahantship through overestimation, the Buddha thinks to them, I shall teach them the Dhamma. Okay? So, but if they're not ready to hear the Dhamma, then he will change his mind. Okay? So that's interesting. Okay, so, and then the Buddha goes on to give quite a nice discourse to Sunakata, quite a long one in Majjhima 105. I won't go into that now. So after that, it seems that he gained faith and ordained. And then we have the record of his monastic career in the Mahali Sutta, where he's trying to get samadhi, but he seems to be more interested in getting this kind of divine ear and being able to hear divine sounds. And as you see, the quite distinctly different kinds of explanations about this given by the commentary and given by the sutta itself. The commentary attributes his failure to his action in a past life of injuring a monk, while the sutta itself attributes his failure to his inability to develop samadhi properly in this life, which gives a rather different kind of perspective on things. So after the Mahali Sutta, then to the Patika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. Patika Sutra of the Digha Nikaya being perhaps one of the less reputable of all of the suttas in the whole canon, not only including the episode where Kaura the Katya came back from the dead, and Kaura the Katya being a dog ascetic. Okay, so he's one of the ones who walks around pretending to be a dog and living his life exactly like a dog. Sunakata was very impressed by this dog duty ascetic and thought that, oh, this must be a real arahant because this is how the arahants live. They live like dogs. And the Buddha said, well, if you live like that, then when you die, you get reborn as a dog. Now, in the Patika Sutta, one part of the Patika Sutta, there comes a discussion of the nature of a lion's roar. The Buddha is challenged by this ascetic Patikaputta, who challenges to come and perform psychic powers. And the Buddha tells the story and said, if the ascetic Gotama comes to meet me, well, if he performs one psychic power, I'll perform two psychic powers, and if he performs two, I'll perform four, and if he performs four, I will perform eight. However many miracles the ascetic Gotama performs, I will perform twice as many. And when the Buddha was asked about this, he said that Patikaputta is not capable of meeting me face to face unless he takes back his words and abandons that thought. If he thinks otherwise, his head will split into pieces. And so when he goes to meet the Buddha, Sunakata proceeding and so on, then Patikaputta is in fact overcome with fear and trembling. His hair stood on end when the Buddha actually accepted his challenge. And Patikaputta said, I'm coming up, friend, I'm coming. But wriggle as he might, he could not get up from his seat. The man said, what's the matter with you, friend Patikaputta? Is your bottom stuck to the seat, or is the seat stuck to your bottom? You keep saying, I'm coming, friend, I'm coming, but you only wriggle and you can't get up from your seat. And even at these words, Patikaputta still wriggled about, but could not rise. And so you have this kind of slapstick comedy of this monk who claims to perform all of these psychic abilities, but he can't even get up from his own seat. And then Jalia, who is a pupil of a wooden bowl ascetic who is coming along for this competition, he said to Patikaputta, "Once, long ago, the lion, the king of beasts, thought, suppose I were to make my lair near a certain jungle. Then I could emerge in the evening, yawn, survey the four quarters, roar my lion's roar 3 times, and then make for the cattle pasture. I could then pick out the very best of the herd for my kill, and having had a good feast of tender meat, return to my lair." And then he did so accordingly. Now, there was an old jackal who had grown fat on the lion's leftovers, and he was proud and strong, and he thought, what difference is there between me and the lion, king of beasts? Suppose I were to make my lair near a certain jungle, emerge in the evening, yawn, survey the four quarters, and roar a lion's roar 3 times, and then go to the cattle pasture and get the best of the cattle. But then when he came out from his lair, surveyed the four quarters, and went to roar his lion's roar, he gave out the howl of his kind, a jackal howl, for what has the wretched howl of a jackal in common with the roar of a lion? So here's a classic comparison in Indian mythology between the lion, the most magnificent and proud of beasts, and the jackal as the scavenger that lives off the leftovers of the lion. So this was something about Sunakatariman in some of his other encounters, as you can see, not particularly auspicious or well developed in his spiritual practice. So finally, he decides, after worrying about who all these other questions, so please take good notice of this. One of Sunakata's great problems was that he kept on worrying about who else was enlightened, and not worrying about his own practice, but worrying about who else was an arahant and what kind of miracles they can do. And of course, this being something which is still very much with us today, and we still find ourselves very much caught up in a lot of people who think that it's very important to go around performing lots of miracles of psychic power, and seem to think that this was something, somehow the essence of the holy life as spoken by the Buddha, whereas in fact, of course, it is nothing of the kind. So, to the sutta itself. Mahasihanada Sutta. The Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Vesali in the grove outside the city to the west. Now on that occasion, Sunakata, the son of the Licharis, had recently left this Dhamma and Vinaya. So again, notice, just as a historical point, Sunakata is the son of the Licharis. It was living near Vesali, so just to point out the stuff in Pali. So one of the reasons I want to use the display, if you can read it, is because when we do the chanting, I can point out some of the words so you can get an idea of what the words that we're chanting are. So he's living in Vesali, of course, being the capital city of the Lichavis, and being the Lichavis being the leading family in that town, or the leading clan in that town. Sunakata was making this a statement before the Vesali assembly. Okay? And the recluse Gotama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. So this being a very important phrase. Nati samanasa Gotama sa uttari manusa dhamma alamari jnana dasana viseso. This is a phrase which is taken exactly from the Vinaya and the Parajika rule of Parajika 4 about claiming superhuman dhammas. And you notice that there's a variant reading here between Uttari Manusa Dhamma and Uttaring Manusa Dhamma. And there's some confusion about what the compound exactly means. Uttari means above, Manusa means human, Dhamma means whatever you want it to mean. Alamaria, enough for the noble knowledge and vision, and we say is a distinction which is sufficient for the noble knowledge and vision, something like that. Uttari Manusa Dhamma, what it actually means here is something which is beyond Manusa Dhamma, okay? So Manusa Dhamma being regarded as the principles of right conduct. So Manusa Dhamma is usually taken to be the 10 pathways of wholesome conduct, the dasa kusala kamapata. Okay? And so these 10, which is like right speech, right action, keeping precepts, and so on and so forth. And these are like the manusa dhamma, because they are the ordinary things which are considered to be the dhamma which is appropriate for the human realm. Okay? So uttaring manusa dhamma, something which is beyond what is the merely human dhamma, i.e. the practice of very high states of samadhi or jhana or psychic powers or states of enlightenment and so on. Usually understood in the Vinaya as referring to primarily to jhanas and the various samadhi states, psychic powers, abhinyas and so on, and the various levels of enlightenment. Okay, these things are the uttaring manusa dhammas. Notice that vipassana jnanas are not listed as uttaring manusa dhammas, but jhanas are. And the recluse Gotama, so he's saying he hasn't seen any of these things. Okay, now, so what he's claiming is that the Buddha hasn't actually experienced and seen the Dhamma for himself. He's saying, he then goes on to say, the recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma merely hammered out by reasoning, following his own line of inquiry as it occurs to him. And when he teaches the Dhamma to anyone, it leads him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering. So this is a somewhat confused assessment of the Buddha's teachings. So when he says that taka, this one here, the taka pariyahatang dhammang deseti, a Dhamma which is hammered out by reason or worked out by reason, this of course is one of the classes of ascetics or philosophers, which is listed in the Brahmajala Sutta and elsewhere. In contrast to those who practice to meditate to realize it, then there's those who think about it and who work out a doctrine which is based on logic and rationality, okay? So that kind of philosopher, of course, is being much more familiar to us from the Greek tradition, and Plato, Socrates, and so on, and these are the ones who try to arrive at the truth through reason, whereas the Indian tradition generally has a higher respect for those who attain the uttaring manusa dhammas. And then he says at the end, and all this does, if you follow and practice this dhamma, is it gets you complete freedom from suffering. And of course, is rather the point. So Sunakata was saying this in the Lichavi assembly. Okay, so the Vesali in the Parisati is in the assembly. So notice he used the word parisa here, being the same as the fourfold parisa of the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen, the same word. And here is used for the assembly or the parisa of the Lichavis or of Vesali. And Vesali being a aristocratic republic of sorts. So this would have been a meeting hall in the middle of the city. They would have had like an open square or an open-sided sala or something like that. And people would meet there for discussions and debates and so on. And so that was where Sunakata was making his declaration. Now, then when it was morning, the Venerable Sariputta, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Vesali for alms. Then he heard Sunakata, son of the Lichavis, making this statement before the Vesali assembly. When he had wandered for alms in Vesali and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One what Sunakata was saying. And the Buddha said, Sariputta, the misguided man Sunakata. So when the text translates the misguided man, is actually a somewhat gentle translation, the Pali word moga purisa, deluded man, stupid man, or something like that. Misguided is a fairly gentle way of putting it. The misguided man Sunakata is angry, and his words are spoken out of anger. Thinking to discredit the Tathagata, he actually praises him. For it is praise of the Tathagata to say of him, when he teaches the Dhamma to anyone, it leads him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering, or the complete ending of suffering. And I've commented on this word before, kaya, here, the Bhikkhu Bodhi is translating as destruction, and I don't think it means destruction. It should translate the ending or the the running out of suffering or the using up of suffering or something like that. Exhaustion of suffering, but not destruction. So, Sariputta, this misguided man, Sunakata, will never affer of me according to Dhamma. That Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable, leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, and blessed. So, this, of course, being the standard passage of recollection of the Buddha we recite every week, and he's saying this Sunakata will not infer according to Dhamma, and this word inferring according to Dhamma here is Dhammanvaya. And so what he's really meaning is that he's never going to attain stream entry while he has this kind of wrong view. He's like blocked from attaining stream entry, and the Dhammanvaya is like a penetration into the nature of Dhamma. The Buddha talked about it elsewhere, where you understand the nature of Dhamma and the nature of the Buddha's enlightenment through your own realization. And he will never infer of me according to Dhamma that Blessed One enjoys the various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, he becomes many. Having been many, he becomes one. He appears and vanishes. He goes unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain, as though through space. He dives in and out of the earth as though it were water. He walks on water without sinking, as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, he travels in space like a bird. With his hand, he touches and strokes the moon and the sun. So powerful and mighty, he wields bodily mastery, even as far as the Brahma world. And so, of course, the standard description of the various kinds of iddhi, or psychic power. And so the Buddha's claiming that not only is Sunakata confused in his criticism, and actually praising him when he tries to criticize, he's actually also factually incorrect, that the Buddha in fact does or can enjoy these various kinds of psychic abilities. And he will never infer of me, according to Dhamma, with the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, that Blessed One hears both kinds of sounds, the heavenly and the human, those that are far as well as near. And he will never infer according to Dhamma, that Blessed One encompasses with his own mind the minds of other beings and other persons, and so on through the various kinds of different mind, with lust, without lust, and so on. Now, so here's some of the standard groups of psychic powers, and notice here we chanted the Satipatthana Sutta just the other day. Saragang va chittang saragang chittanti pajanati, vitaragang va chittang vitaragang chittanti pajanati, sadosang va chittang sadosang chittanti pajanati, vitadosang va chittang vitadosang chittanti pajanati, and so on and so forth. So this is the standard passage on the psychic power of being able to read the minds of other people. Okay, so when the suttas depict that skill, this is how they depict it, and it's exactly the same as the psychic power of being able to read, or the meditative power to be able to read one's own mind. Yeah, and so in the Satipatthana Sutta it says ajhatangva bahidhava, one contemplates internally and externally. So the internal power is the ability to read your own mind, the external power the ability to read the minds of others. And it should hardly need emphasizing that the important one is, as Ajahn Chah said, the ability to read your own mind. And so here the Buddha making the claim to possess these various kinds of powers. One of the interesting points about the narrative, of course, is that you know, Sunakata, obviously he's looking for miracles. Obviously he wants a teacher who's going to be going around doing all of these kinds of very obvious things. And it's quite apparent. He was living with the Buddha for many years. In Mahali Sutra it said he was there for 3 years at least. So he's hanging around with the Buddha for many years and has no evidence that the Buddha was actually doing any kind of psychic events at all, which is quite remarkable, isn't it? And if we look in the later scriptures, then they will say that the Buddha is kind of basically doing these kinds of psychic stuff all the time. He's walking along manifesting radiance, and there's flowers falling out of the sky, and he's walking, and all of these kinds of stuff's going on all the time. And the early suttas are very restrained in their treatment of these things, and so it seems that it's quite possible for somebody, even if they're looking for it, even if he wants the Buddha to experience, to perform psychic powers, and he wants to be convinced of his miracles, to live with the Buddha for many years without seeing any evidence of these kinds of things. Of course, we could, it's quite possible that the Buddha would have been using the more subtle of these kinds of abilities, like his ability to read people's minds and things, and to be using them, the ones that are not so obvious. But certainly it seems that the more blatant kinds of abilities were not something that he was displaying on a regular basis. So the sutta then goes on to talk about various other kinds of abilities and attributes of the Buddha. So the first one is the 10 Tathagata Balas. Dasa Kopani Mani Sariputta Tathagata Tathagata Balani. 10 indeed, these Sariputta of the Tathagata powers. So there are these 10 Tathagata powers of a Tathagata, endowed with which the Tathagata makes known declares the claims the herd leader's place. And so notice here the use not only of the lion, okay, he roars, the lion's roar in the assemblies, and also the asabha is the bull. So this is, these are two of the very powerful animals in Indic thought. If you look in the Ashokan columns, King Ashoka used four animals to represent his realm: the elephant, the lion, the bull, and the horse. So these four animals are regarded as being very noble in Indic mythology, and the Buddha very commonly using them in that way in metaphors. Okay, so the 10 powers of the Tathagata. So it's very interesting to notice what's included here in the 10 powers of the Tathagata. Also interesting to notice what's not included in the 10 powers of a Tathagata and these other abilities which the Buddha is claiming in this sutta. The 10 powers are not unique to the Buddha. Elsewhere, some of the disciples, I believe Venerable Anuruddha, if I'm not mistaken, and possibly Kassapa, also claim to possess these abilities. Here, the Tathagata understands as it actually is, the possible as possible and the impossible as impossible. And that is a Tathagata's power that the Tathagata has by virtue of which he claims the herd leader's place, roars his lion's roar and in the assemblies and sets rolling the wheel of Brahma. So this topic of the possible and impossible is taken up in the Bahudatuka Sutta, which is Majjhima, see if I can find it. Bahudatuka 925. So I'll just give a few examples of that Majjhima. Majjhima 115. And the possible and impossible, that it is impossible that a person possessing right view should treat any sankhara, any conditioned things, as permanent. But it is possible that an ordinary human might treat some sankhara as permanent. And it is impossible that someone possessing right view, and here meaning a stream mantra, could deprive his mother of life. It's impossible. And it is possible that an ordinary person might deprive his mother of life. And so on and so forth. So it goes through a whole list of various things which are considered to be possible or impossible. So understanding the nature of people and their conduct. So the second one, the Tathagata understands as it actually is, the results of actions undertaken, past, future, and present, by way of possibilities and causes. Okay? So he knows that if you undertake certain kinds of kammas, then this will lead to certain kinds of results. And notice that here the term it's actually using is kamma samadana, which is usually used, for example, in the context of like undertaking the precepts. So to samadana is to undertake the precepts or something like that. So to undertake kamma, this is an interesting point, because often we think of kamma as intention. Of course, kamma is our intention, but sometimes people get worried because they think they maybe have lots of intentions during the day which are good or bad or whatever, and they get kind of worried about it. But this act of samadhana, of actually undertaking or taking up, rightly taking up, a particular course of action or a particular karma is much more powerful, and this is the thing which will actually lead to the results. Okay? So even though your mind is changeable and the mind may be flickering here and there and thinking all kinds of good and bad thoughts and so on, but it's those big things which you undertake and which you do which give a long-term direction to your mind, and which they are the ones that actually lead to the appropriate kind of vipaka. Okay? So this is one of the things that Tathagata understands. Again, the Tathagata understands as it actually is the ways leading to all destinations. Okay? Sabbata gamining patipadang. So the ways leading to all destinations, of course, the ways leading is the patipadang, or the practices leading to all destinations. Okay? So this is not meaning that he was like a substitute for whereis.com. And so if you needed to know what is the way to Barrel or something, you go to the Buddha and ask him what the way. This isn't the point, but he knows which kind of spiritual practices are going to be leading to which kind of destinies. So, for example, you do a certain kind of practice and this will lead to rebirth in a certain heaven realm, or if you do a certain kind of, like the example we did before, talked about before, of the dog duty ascetic. And the Buddha knew that if you'd practiced and to imitating a dog, and devoted your life to imitating a dog, then if you're lucky, you get reborn in the realm of dogs. If you're lucky. So this is the way of practices. Okay? Again, the Tathagata understands as it actually is the world with its many and different elements. Okay? So this is knowing the aneka dhatu nana dhatu lokang. So the many different aspects of the world, many different properties of the world, which the Buddha knows. He knows the complexities of these things. Okay? And of course the elements being discussed in many different suttas. Then the Tathagata understands as it actually is how beings have different inclinations. Okay? So this one is nanadhimutti katang. Okay? Satanang nana dhimutti katang. So knowing there's different people have different characteristics and so on. He understands the disposition of the faculties of other beings and other persons, okay? So this is the indriya paro pariyatang, okay? So knowing the different faculties, the different indriyas of different beings. So this is the knowledge, one of the knowledges that the Buddha had, on just before just when Brahma begged him to teach the Dhamma, and then he surveyed the different beings and he knew that there are beings with different faculties. So some here faculties having a meaning of something like spiritual potential, okay? And so he's knowing that some beings have a greater kind of spiritual potential than others. This is the phrase which in later Buddhism often is, this is the closest phrase actually to what in later Buddhism we refer to as the paramis. And so in later Buddhism we get used to this idea of the spiritual qualities or perfections which are developed over many, many lifetimes, gradually developing different kind of perfections and those kind of building up. This kind of idea is not really found in the early suttas. And this, perhaps this usage here is just about the closest that we find to that kind of thing, that different beings have different faculties. Some have more potential than others. There's some who you try to teach them and no matter what you do, then you're not really going to have much luck. Other ones then can teach them only a very short time and they will have a great success. But notice how the teaching of the indriyas in this case is not really linked to past life stuff, although obviously it is related to that. But it's not sort of directly derived from past life practice, as we understand the paramis to be. So, the next one is the defilement, the cleansing, and the emergence in regard to the jhanas, liberations, concentrations, and attainments. So here's the jhanas, the vimokha is liberations, samadhi, and samapatti meaning attainments, the defilement, sankilesa, the cleaning, pure purification of them, and the uttana, the emergence from them. Okay, so this is talking about his expertise in samadhi practice, and he knows about all the different kinds of samadhi that there are, the things that obstruct them, how to purify them, and so on and so forth. And so this referring to his mastery in jhanas. Craven, what are you going to say? Vipassana jhanas, again, not mentioned there. Okay, so, right, next. And then, the Tathagata recollects his manifold past lives, that is one birth, two births, and so on. And then with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and reappearing. And finally, he realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he enters upon in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom. Okay, so here we have the remaining, what they call abhinya. So usually you have a list of six abhinya. And before we started this group of the Tathagata Balas, we had three of the abhinya. And so this now explains why we didn't have the rest of the abhinya at that stage, because they're included in the Tathagata Balas. So then first mentions the iddhis, the psychic abilities, then the divine ear, and then the reading other people's minds. These are the not in the Tathagata Balas, so it mentioned those first, and then the final three abhinya, or the tevijja, in the Tathagata Balas. Okay, so of course many interesting phrases, this particular passage being the standard passage on the realization of arahantship, and just draw your attention to this one phrase, cheto vimutting panya vimutting. Okay, and vimutti being release or liberation, cheto meaning heart. Or jeto usually means the mind, obviously, but means the mind in its emotional context, and panya means the mind in its more intellectual or cognitive context. And so this jeto imuting, referring to the release which is associated with or on the side of samadhi. So it's like the samadhi aspect of liberation, panya being the wisdom aspect of liberation. And so arahantship, of course, always described as both of these two things, jeto vimutti and panya vimutti. These are not two alternatives, that all arahants are released through both of these things, although, of course, they might emphasize one or the other.
Jeto vimutti is also what metta is.
Metta is described as jeto vimutti, yeah. And I think some of the other attainments. I don't think the jhanas as such are described as jeto vimutti, but the Brahma Viharas are, and maybe the Arupa attainments, possibly fourth jhana. Okay, so any questions on the various Tathagata Balas before we proceed? Right. So then Buddha says to Sariputta, Sariputta, when I know and see thus, should anyone say of me, the recluse Gotama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. The recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma hammered out by reasoning, following his own line of inquiry as it occurs to him, unless he abandons that assertion and that state of mind and relinquishes that view, then as surely as if he had been carried off and put there, he will wind up in hell. Right. Just as a bhikkhu possessed of virtue, concentration, and wisdom would here and now enjoy final knowledge, so it will happen in this case. I say that unless he abandons that assertion and that state of mind and relinquishes that view, then as surely as if he'd been carried off and put there, he will wind up in hell. So that's pretty heavy, isn't it? Poor old Sunakata. And this, of course, being an example of one of the Tathagata Balas, knowing the destinies of all ways of practice, yeah? So, okay. The next one is, the Buddha talks about, and goes on to talk about various other different kinds of groups of dhammas, okay? The next one being the four kinds of intrepidity, alright? And Vesa Raja, the Chattarimani Sariputta Tathagatasa Vesa Rajani, again endowed with which he roars his lion's roar.
Oh, that could be interpreted as being a little draconian.
Well, it could be interpreted that way, for sure, yeah. I mean, he's obviously not cursing him or anything like that, but he's sort of pointing out, well, this is where that way leads. But Certainly, it sounds pretty heavy.
It's a bit like, if you don't believe in Jesus, you go to hell.
If you don't believe in Jesus, you go to hell, yeah? Mm-hmm. If you don't believe in the Buddha, you go to hell, maybe? Yeah.
Is the translation accurate, or is it...
Yeah, the translation's accurate.
Sorry? Anywhere else in the sutra?
I can't...
Yeah, that's not fine.
There are things similar to that. I'm not sure if there's one exactly the same as that. Anywhere else?
What is meant by hell?
What is meant by hell? Hell's a state of rebirth, a place where you go to which is very unpleasant and which lasts for a lot longer than you would want it to last, and but which is impermanent and which is produced through your own bad karma. Yeah, so it's something which is produced through your own bad karma. It's not like a punishment which is imposed on you externally. So it lasts for a period of time and then you're kind of released from it. Yeah, so this is what it meant here. The actual idiom that Bhikkhu Bodhi is translating here is very problematic and has been much discussed by Pali scholars, but most of them end up translating it something like Bhikkhu Bodhi has here. Where's the actual idiom? Yathabhatang nikito evang niraye. It's very, this one here. Yathabhatang nikito evang niraye. Very difficult to make out what the grammar of it means, but it seems to be. Niraya is one of the standard words for hell in the Buddhist sense.
What's the word tatta mean?
Tatta means there.
It appears quite often.
Yep. It means there and also means in that regard or in that respect. Yeah, it's sometimes translated as therein. That's good. That's one of the reasons why I'm doing this. If anyone has any questions about particular words that we're chanting and you want to know what they mean, then please ask. So this is one of the reasons why we're doing this, so that we can gain familiarity with the Pali. So as we do our chanting and continue doing that every week, we can gradually learn a few more words and get a better idea of what it is. Yeah, I think it's a bit. I mean, I think it's a bit more extreme than that. I mean, I think it's the case where Sunakata had a pretty good chance. You know, been following the Buddha around for several years. The Buddha had spent quite a lot of time teaching him and helping him and so on. And then he was like deliberately defaming him and putting him down after the Buddha had already kind of, you know. So it's not like it's just he happened to say something bad and the Buddha came out with this. It's like after the end result of quite a long process.
Doesn't it say that it's actually his belief of these things that
also says assertion. Let me see what whether that means Matravatamang. Okay. Vachang. Yeah, it says vacha, which means speech. So it's also talking about his state of mind of view, but also talking about his statements that he's making. So I mean, the implication to me, it seems that the implication is that he's making a, like a deliberate and quite malicious attack on the Buddha.
So it's basically he's using hatred.
Yeah, that's what he said earlier, yeah. Yeah.
Do they have similar, do you know, in the Vedas, in the Upanishads, or...
Oh yeah, that's like a really strong part of the Indic tradition for sure. Yeah, if you revile a Brahmin, constantly talking about that in the myths and the Mahabharata and things like that. Yeah, reviling the Brahmins is one of the worst things that you can do. That's why the Buddha went to hell. Yeah, that's what it would be right. The Upanishads wouldn't have that kind of thing, but in the mythologies. Yeah. Okay. So, four grounds for intrepidity, okay? Intrepidity. Some people might think that when we translate intrepidity, we might as well leave it as Vesaraja, because we have no idea of what either intrepidity or Vesaraja means. Intrepidity, but the meaning of it becomes clear enough from the, context. It means just supreme confidence and bravery, courage. So the four grounds. Here I see no ground on which any recluse or Brahman or God or Mara or Brahma or anyone else in the world could, in accordance with Dhamma, accuse me thus, while you claim to be fully enlightened, you are not fully enlightened about these things. Okay, so this is the first ground, that his claim to full enlightenment is in fact justified. Second one, while you claim to be one who has ended the defilements, you have not ended these defilements. This is the second one. The third one, those things called obstructions by you are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. And this being the other one. And this is treated in more detail in the Alagadupama Sutta, which we will be discussing in a few weeks. Okay, when you teach the Dhamma to someone who, it does not lead him when he practices it to the complete ending of suffering, and seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearlessness, and intrepidity. So, this referring to the claim of Sunakata also. So his Dhamma merely leads to the ending of suffering. Okay, so the intrepidity, then for the eight assemblies, the next one. So, Atta ko ima sariputta parisa, eight assemblies, again the word parisa. What eight? The Katiya parisa, the assembly of Katiyas. The Buddha, of course, because of his bias for the Katiyans, always puts them first. The Brahmana parisa, the assembly of Gahapatis, of householders. So Gahapati is kind of a little bit ambiguous in our sense, but it doesn't just mean any, it's often used in a sense of just meaning any lay person is called a Gahapati, so it's like maybe contrasted with an ascetic. But actually, the meaning is a little bit more exalted than that. Gaha is a house, Pati is a lord, like so a householder or a house lord, or even like landlord, perhaps. And so in those days, of course, in most societies, there'd been quite a clear distinction about this between the landowners and the serfs or something like that. So the Gahapatis being those who actually own houses. Samana, Parisa, assembly of samanas or ascetics. The Chatu Maharajika Parisa, the assembly of the devas of the four great kings. The assembly of the Tavatinsa devas, 33. The assemblies of Maras. And the Brahma Parisa, the assembly of Brahmas. Okay, these eight assemblies, and this being one of the standard lists in early Buddhist texts, and even though it's a fairly minor list as such, but the interesting thing about it, one of the interesting things about it, there was a suggestion which was developed by my friend Rod Bucknell that the Saggata Wagga of the Sanyutta Nikaya was at one stage organized according to the scheme of the eight assemblies. And there seems to be something to that. So, then he says, I recall having approached many hundred assemblies of nobles, of Katiyas, many hundreds of assemblies of Brahmins, many hundreds of assemblies of householders, many hundred assemblies of recluses, many hundred assemblies of gods of the heaven of the four great kings of the 33. Of Mara's retinue, and many hundreds of assemblies of Brahmas. And formerly I have sat with them there and talked with them and held conversations with them, and yet I see no ground for thinking that fear or timidity might come upon me there. And seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearlessness, and intrepidity. So, this is another thing about the Buddha's discussion of the eight assemblies. Elsewhere, when he talks about this, he says when he appears to these eight assemblies, he actually, first of all, he disguises himself so that he looks just like one of them, right? So first of all, he takes on the appearance of a Brahmin or of a god of the 33 or something, and then he approaches them and he sits among them, and then he teaches them the Dhamma, and then later on he disappears as mysteriously as he appeared, and they do not know, is this a man or is this a god who has appeared among us? Yeah? So you never know. He might be with you. In the assembly. Hundreds of times he did this. It's quite interesting. Okay, so the next one. The four kinds. Aneka Satang. Another interesting little group found in early Buddhism. Now, there are these four kinds of generation, or four kinds of yoni. Yoni, of course, meaning the womb, and here meaning four kinds of ways of being born. Being born from a, first of all, egg-born generation, obviously from an egg, womb-born generation, moisture-born generation, and spontaneous generation, okay? So then goes on to explain what these four are, and what is egg-born generation? These are beings, they're beings born by breaking out of the shell of an egg, fair enough. What is womb-born generation? There are these beings born out from breaking out of the call. This is called womb-born generation. And, of course, it's just referring to ordinary mammalian birth. What is moisture-born generation? There are these beings born in a rotten fish, in a rotten corpse, in rotten porridge, in a cesspit or in a sewer. This is called moisture-born generation. And what is spontaneous generation? There are gods and denizens of hell and certain human beings and some beings in the lower worlds. These are called spontaneous generation. So ghosts and hell beings and heavenly beings and so on are born spontaneously. They just appear. And certainly certain human beings as well, apparently, are just pop, there they are. And they don't have to go through the whole womb and growing up thing. According to the tradition, Ambapali, I think, the courtesan, was a spontaneously born. Upalavana. Because was it Upalavana?
Upalavana was born out of lotus.
Was born out of lotus. Yeah, that's from the name. But I think Ambapali was regarded as being born spontaneously because of the merit that she made in past life as a bhikkhuni. But unfortunately, she also made very bad demerit because she was walking through the monastery in a line of bhikkhunis. And the leading bhikkhuni spat on the ground, and she said to herself, "What whore did that?" And unfortunately, the bhikkhuni happened to be an arahant, so she got reborn as a prostitute in 500 lifetimes as a result of that. Got the commentary of the story about poor old Ambapali. Anyway, but because of her good karma, she got reborn spontaneously, so she didn't have to go through the whole growing up thing. So
this is our commentary.
That's commentary.
No, that's me. Now, why this should be here, I don't know. Does anyone have any idea?
The Buddha himself was womb-born, not spontaneous-born.
Yeah?
You'd think that if anyone was to be...
Any humans were to be spontaneously born, yeah. But why is it? Why is it in this particular sutta?
Perhaps it's so much like the cows.
Yeah, maybe being able to know... Yeah, I guess so. Okay, five destinations, five gatis. So here the word for destination being gati. Panch ko ima sariputta gatiyo. Atama pancha, what five? Nirayo, hell. Tirachanayoni, the womb of an animal or the animal realm. Peti visaya, which is the realm of the...
Katama is what is it?
Sorry? Katama is what? Yeah, what five? Yeah. Generally speaking, in Pali, the question words start with a K. Okay? It's not the, of course, other words start with K as well. But in English, of course, question words often start with WH, like where, why, what, and so on. So those words in Pali tend to start with a K. You have this phenomenon in Pali where the I'll go down to the end here. I'm looking right here. Oh, it's a PDF. Okay, never mind. Yeah, anyway, means what five? Hell beings, animal being, animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, human realm, Manusa, the Deva realm, and the Deva realm is the fifth. Okay, and then it says, I understand hell and the path and way leading to hell. I also understand how one who has entered this path will, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappear in a state of deprivation and unhappy destination in perdition in hell. And similarly with the animal realm, the realm of ghosts, the realm of human beings, the realm of gods. And finally he says, he adds to this, I understand Nibbana and the path and way leading to Nibbana, and talks about that. So then he goes on further to discuss the way that he does it with some fairly graphic similes. By encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts himself, he's taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation in hell. Then, later on, with the divine... So this is the first stage, is he reads his mind and he understands, oh, this person's acting in such a way, this is going to lead him to hell. Then later on, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I see that after he's died, he reappears in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination in hell, and is experiencing exclusively painful, racking, piercing feelings. And then gives a simile. Suppose there were a charcoal pit, deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals, without flame or smoke. And then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only, and directed to that same charcoal pit. Then a man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves and so conducts himself has taken such a path that he will come to this same charcoal pit. And later on he sees that he has fallen into that charcoal pit and is experiencing exclusively painful, racking, piercing feelings. So this is the kind of simile the Buddha would give for hell. Doesn't sound like it's something that one wants to test for oneself. Interesting to notice, a couple of things, interesting things there. One is that if you take that simile seriously, then of course it's not talking about like something which is determined or fatalistic, because somebody who's walking along a path that leads to a charcoal pit, well, maybe they're not going to walk into the charcoal pit. But if they keep on doing what they're doing, then it's going to lead to the charcoal pit. Of course, they always have the choice to stop what they're doing and come back. Okay, and so it's not saying that necessarily you're kind of destined to do that, but it's saying that you're doing that practice which is going to be leading in that direction.
As if saying he uses the divine eye to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is.
Yeah. Once he's seen it, yeah. Once he's actually seen that he's yeah, afterwards and using the divine eye. So there's two abilities. One is to read the mind in the first place, and then he knows, oh, okay, that state of mind will lead to that rebirth. Yeah, and then afterwards he sees that he's actually gone there. So this is the interesting linguistic little detail here is ekaya nena magena. Okay, so this is the path leading only in one direction, is the ekayana magga. So this is, of course, we discussed this in a discussion of Satipatthana earlier, and this being the only place in the Pali scriptures, or the early Pali scriptures, where ekayana magga is used in a kind of a non-doctrinal sense. It's used in a ordinary, everyday sense of just walking along a path that leads in just one direction. Okay, and then goes on to talk about the rebirth in the animal realm, and then the person again, he understands his state of mind that's going to lead to the animal realm, and then gives a simile for this. Suppose there were a cesspit deeper than a man's height, full of filth. So this is a bit like our grey water system out the back here, except actually if we were to imagine if that tub of water and slime, and we were to actually just dump our compost into there week after week until it was full of filth. It's a bit like the pit of rubbish that I fell into when I was in Anagarika working in the kitchen in Dowdham. Then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same cesspit. And then he would know that that person is going to that same place. Okay. Then the simile for the ghost realm, the same thing in the ghost realm. The simile is, suppose there were a tree growing on uneven ground with scanty foliage, casting a dappled shadow, perhaps like a gum tree in Australia. And then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same tree. Okay, so the notice how the similes are getting progressively less aggressive and less bad. Yeah, we started out with a scorching, burning charcoal pit, which you wouldn't want to stay in there even for half a second. It would be very bad. And then there's a cesspit, which is also pretty bad, but not perhaps as bad as a burning charcoal pit. And now we've just got merely a rough piece of ground and not much shade. Okay, and so this is like the ghost realm. Then, By compassing mind with mind, then he's reappeared among human beings. Suppose there were a tree growing on even ground with thick foliage casting a deep shade, and a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that tree. Okay, so that's a sign of the general pleasantness of the human realm. Then the heavenly realm. Suppose there were a mansion, and it had an upper chamber, plastered within and without, shut off, secured by bars, with shuttered windows, and in it there were a couch, spread with rugs, blankets and sheets, with a deer-skin coverlet, and with a canopy, as well as crimson pillows for both head and feet, and then a man scorched and exhausted by the hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same mansion. Okay, so this is the simile for the heavenly realms. And so it sounds like most people in Australia these days living in the heaven realms. And then finally the simile for Nibbana. Suppose there were a pond with clean, agreeable, cool water, transparent, with smooth banks, delightful, and nearby a dense wood. And then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only towards that same pond. And so the person were to see him later on, and he had plunged into the pond, bathed, drunk, and relieved all his distress, fatigue, and fever, and has come out again and is sitting or lying in the wood, experiencing exclusively pleasant feelings. So this is the very beautiful simile for Nibbana. And of course, being a simile which was very potent in the time of the Buddha in India, where it's extremely hot and sweaty and dusty and all of those things, so being a very potent simile. And this simile is actually in evoked in the Ratna Sutta. How does it go again? The Yesupa Yuta Manasadalhena Nikamino Gautama Sasanam Hite Patipata Amatang Vigaiha Ladham Udham Nibuting Bhunjamana. So they've kind of plunged into the deathless, uses this kind of imagery, and this being the basis for this kind of metaphor. Okay. So following this, the Buddha then goes on to talk about his practice of austerities, and remembering that elsewhere in the other suttas, the Sunakata had indicated his faith and liking for the ascetics who are doing the dog duty ascetics, and said these are real arahant ascetics, and this being one of his criticisms of the Buddha, that he was a bit of a softy. And so here the Buddha saying how he himself was the great tapasi, okay? Okay, so here's the Buddha saying, I was the great tapasi. I've been a supreme tapasi. I've been coarse, very coarse. And I've been very scrupulous, supremely scrupulous, and I've been secluded, supremely secluded. And I'll just check the footnote here. And Bhikkhu Bodhi here refers to another couple of suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, which also refer to the ascetic practices. But we'll just read this one here for now. Such was my asceticism, Sariputta. Okay. Okay, so by asceticism here is tapasita. Okay, so such was his tapasiness, right? That I went naked, right? So we're not making any suggestions here. Rejecting conventions, licking my hands, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. Okay? So he's like perversely just going against anything which is the custom, just for the sake of it, yeah? And, I did not accept food brought, or food specially made, or an invitation to a meal. I received nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold, across a stick. Okay? So that means that, like, if you're going for alms round, and you could have come into the house, and somebody's standing on the threshold of the house, like if they're standing beside the front door there, you know, he wouldn't accept it if you were standing on one side of the door and then they were standing on the other side, right? Across a stick, like if there's a stick laying on the ground or something like that, you wouldn't accept the thing. Across a pestle from two eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman in the midst of men, from where food was advertised to be distributed. All right. So that's, of course, another ascetic practice. Like if they say, oh, there's food available, you know, come and help yourself, then, oh, no, I'm not going to go there. All right. From where a dog was waiting. Again, this is going to be pretty hard, you know. There's a lot of dogs around the place, you know. You go to this house and there's no dogs. From where flies were buzzing. All right. I certainly wouldn't have done very well in Australia. I accepted no fish or meat. I drank no liquor, wine, or fermented brew. Okay, obviously the last one being a very extreme practice, which we don't need to follow. But okay, I kept to one house, one morsel, to two houses, two morsels, seven houses, seven morsels. I lived on one saucerful a day, to two saucerfuls a day, seven saucerfuls. I took food once a day, once every 2 days, once every 7 days. That's even up to once every fortnight. I dwelt pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. I was an eater of greens or millet or wild rice or hide parings. The bits that are cleaned off the hides of horses or cows or leather and stuff. Or moss. Or rice bran, or rice scum, or sesame flour, or grass, or cow dung. I lived on forest roots and fruits. I fed on fallen fruits. I clothed myself in hemp mixed cloth, hemp cloth being like the sackcloth that we have, in very, very coarse cloth, in shrouds, not like the very luxurious hemp stuff you can actually buy these days, very nice hempen cloth, but this is like the sackcloth. In shrouds, in refuse rags, in tree bark. So this is referring to rags which are like recovered from the rubbish and so on, or recovered from the charnel ground, the ones which have been used to wrap corpses in which have rotted away. Dressed in tree bark, in antelope hide, in strips of antelope hide, this being a classic Rishi's dress in India. In kusa grass fabric, kusa grass is this kind of very prickly grass which can cut your hand when you grasp it the wrong way, so dressing in kusa grass would be extremely painful. In bark fabric, in wood shavings fabric. How are you going to weave fabric out of wood shavings? I'm not quite sure of that one. In head hair wool. And elsewhere the Buddha declared that of all garments, the garment of human hair was the worst. It was the hottest in summer and the coldest in winter and prickly and uncomfortable. In animal wool, doesn't sound too bad, in owl's wings. I was one who pulled out hair and beard, pursuing the practice of pulling out hair and beard. I was one who stood continuously, rejecting seats. I was one who squatted continuously, devoted to maintaining the squatting posture. I was one who used a mattress of spikes. I made a mattress of spikes my bed. I dwelt pursuing the practice of bathing in water 3 times daily, including the evening. doesn't sound too bad, but in such a variety of ways I dwelt pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. Such was my asceticism. So the Buddha here roaring this lion's roar. Now, of course, many, if not all of those practices are very, very similar to the practices described in the Jaina scriptures, and particularly the one is the pulling out the hair and beard. And this is how they go forth. So rather than shaving off, they actually pull it all out. And for some reason which may or may not be related to that, the Jain Sangha is finding it difficult to recruit members these days. But also many of those other kinds of practices, like not eating from a pot and getting an invitation to a meal and all of these kinds of things, it's all very Jain. And in the Jain scriptures, all that kind of stuff is going through there all the time. And there's one particular famous story, which is about the first Jain nun. And made a determination before his enlightenment. Like, I don't know if I can remember all the factors, but it had like 8 factors or something. So he wouldn't receive any food at all, right? He wouldn't take any food except for receiving from someone who was a princess with a shaven head,
crying
across the threshold. And it had to be like just, I think, bean or something. Yeah, something like that. And all of these different factors. And so, of course, he didn't eat for a very, very long time. He'd go for alms around every day. but didn't get any of these things. And then one day there was this one woman who had been a princess but had been kidnapped and then kept as kind of like a prisoner, as a slave and so on. And then she came out to offer. And she came out to offer, and she was a princess. She had a shaven head because she was a slave. And she was offering across the threshold. She was offering beans, all of these kinds of things. But she wasn't crying. Yeah? And so Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, went up to take arms, and he realized she wasn't crying. So he said, okay, that doesn't fulfill my criteria. So he walked off. And as he walked off, she was so upset that he didn't take her food that she started crying. So, oh, river fantasy. Went back and got some beans.
It seems that Jainism was a very influential religion.
It was, yeah. Yeah. And this kind of episode, you know, to me strongly suggests that the Buddha was a Jain ascetic before he was a Buddhist, yeah, before his enlightenment. He was certainly practicing something very close to Jainism, if not actually a disciple. The Buddhist scriptures don't say he was a Jain as such, but the Jain scriptures do. The Jain scriptures say that he spent time as a Jain ascetic before taking up Buddhism. Yeah. The other little hint about that is that after he decided to give up his ascetic practices, the group of five monks rejected him, who were his followers. They rejected him, they went to stay in the deer park, okay, where he later taught the first sermon. And in the deer park to this very day, there's a Jain temple. So, again, perhaps being a hint that certainly he was in those circles, whether it was actually defined as a Jain or not.
Also, Bhante, yeah. Right here was a big Jain.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. A lot of the temples on the hilltops there. Okay, so this is asceticism, and now his coarseness. Such was my coarseness that just as the bole, not sure what a bole is here, B-O-L-E, of a tinduka tree accumulating over the years, cakes and flakes off, so too dust and dirt accumulating over the years, caked off my body and flaked off. And it never occurred to me, oh, let me rub this dust and dirt off with my hand, or let another rub this dust and dirt off with his hand. It never occurred to me, thus, such was my coarseness. Such was my scrupulousness, Sariputta, that I was always mindful in stepping forwards and stepping backwards. I was full of pity, even regard to a drop of water. Thus, let me not hurt the tiny creatures in the crevices of the ground. So, that being somewhat nicer than the previous ones, but interesting to notice the usage here. Satova, of course, being mindful, of course, being the great Buddhist quality of mindfulness, the same word here, abhikkhamati, but satova patikkhamami, this being the same words, abhikkhante, patikkhante, sampajana, sakari, hoti, in the Satipatthana Sutta, or in the gradual training about the going out and then returning. One acts with clear comprehension. Here the word sato is used, mindfulness is used instead of clear comprehension. But this is one of the passages that very clearly shows that mindfulness as such is not a Buddhist practice. And here the Buddha, before he became a Buddhist, before his enlightenment, was doing these practices of Jains or whoever they were, and was practicing mindfulness in very much the same way that we would practice it today. Okay? So, such was my seclusion, Sariputta, that I would plunge into some forest and dwell there. And when I saw a cowherd or a shepherd or someone gathering grass or sticks or a woodsman, I would flee from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket, from hollow to hollow, from hillock to hillock. Why was that? So that they should not see me or I see them, just as a forest-bred deer, on seeing human beings, flees from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket, from hollow to hollow, from hillock to hillock, so too I fled when I saw any other people. I would go on all fours to the cow pens when the cattle had gone out and the cowherd had left them, and I would feed on the dung of the young suckling calves. As long as my own excrement and urine lasted, I fed on my own excrement and urine. Such was my great practice of feeding on filth. So, what can you say? All I can say is I'm glad I've got the right religion. And he decided that these things didn't work. That's really wonderful. I would plunge into some awe-inspiring grove and dwell there, a grove so awe-inspiring that it would make most of the man's hairs stand up if he were not freed from lust. When those cold, wintry nights came during the 8 periods of snowfall, I would dwell by night in the open and by day in the grove. So, coming out into the open, of course, being the coldest place at night, out of the protection of the forest. And according to the commentary, the 8 periods of snowfall occurs over the last 4 days of the month Magha and the first 4 days of the month Phaguna, i.e. in late February. However, the cold period in South Asia typically falls in late December or early January. I mean, these days it doesn't get that cold, and maybe the it says the snow is falling, either the weather's changed in that region or else perhaps the snowfall was in like the northern regions around Lumbini or Nepal area. In the last month of the hot season, I would dwell by day in the open and by night in the grove. And then there would, so in the hot season, you come out in the daytime into the open. Then, so it's as hot as possible. Then there came to me spontaneously this stanza never heard before. Chilled by night and scorched by day, alone in awe-inspiring groves, naked, no fire to sit beside, the sage yet pursues his quest. I would make my bed in a charnel ground with the bones of the dead for a pillow. And cowherd boys came up and spat on me, urinated on me, threw dirt on me, and poked sticks into my ears. Yet I do not recall that I ever roused an evil mind of hate against them. Such was my abiding in equanimity. Sariputta, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. Purification comes about through food. They say, let us live on kola fruits. Nothing to do with Coca-Cola, of course. And they eat kola fruits, they eat kola fruit powder, they drink kola fruit water, and they make many kinds of kola fruit concoctions. Now, I recall having eaten a single kola fruit a day. Sariputta, you might think that the kola fruit was bigger at that time, yet you should not regard it so. The kola fruit was then at most the same size as now. Okay, so don't think the Buddha was indulging by eating these huge kola fruits. No, not like that. I don't know what a kola fruit is. Does anyone know what a kola fruit is?
Probably some kind of small berry.
Yeah, small kind of berry. Not a jackfruit or something. Through feeding on a single kola fruit a day, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. My limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. My backside became like a camel's hoof. The projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. My ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Very lovely, vivid images there. The gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like a gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. My scalp shriveled and withered as a green bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. My belly skin, it stuck to my backbone. If I touched my belly skin, I felt my backbone. And if I wanted to touch my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I wanted to defecate or urinate, I fell over on my face right there. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots fell from my body as I rubbed. Very unforgettable images here, of course, this being immortalized in the images of the emaciated Buddha, which you see, or emaciated Bodhisattva, which you see from time to time. And one of my friends said they once saw a postcard from Sri Lanka that had one of these pictures of the starving Bodhisattva, and perhaps under Christian influence it said underneath there, he suffered for us. Sariputta, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. Purification comes out through food. They say let us live on beans or sesame or rice, and they eat rice. So I ate one rice grain a day. You might think that the rice grain was bigger in those days, but you should not think so. It was just the same size as now. Okay. But yet by such conduct, by such practice, by such performance of austerities, I did not attain any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision, worthy of the noble ones. Why is that? Because I did not attain that noble wisdom, which when attained is noble and emancipating and leads the one who practices it in accordance with it to the complete ending of suffering. Sariputta, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. Purification comes about through the round of rebirths, samsara sudhi. So this is the doctrine of one of the escapes me at the moment exactly which one it was of according to the Samanyapala Sutta is the doctrine of one of the other the very well known group of six ascetics. And according to Samanyapala Sutta, this particular doctrine was the doctrine of Makkali Gosala. So it's the doctrine of Makkali Gosala, the founder of the Ajivikas. So this is Samsara Sudhi, and
so that's what the Ajivikas believe in.
Yeah, that's right. So Samsara Sudhi, and so that means basically that there's you're allotted a certain amount of lives, and that you've got to just go through all of those lives, and at the end of it you get released, okay? And whether you do anything about that or not doesn't make any difference. But it is not easy to find a kind of rebirth that I've not been reborn in already in this long journey, except for the gods of the pure abodes. So the Buddha is saying, well, he's been to all of those different places already. The only place, of course, he hasn't been is the pure abodes, which is reserved for anagamis only. Then there are certain reclusive Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this: purification comes about through some abode, some particular abode, but it is not easy to find an abode that I've not already dwelt in. So here the word for abode is avasa, and here obviously meaning again a plane of rebirth. So the difference between the two views seems to be that the Saraswati or round of rebirths. Oh, the next one, I missed that one. Okay, paragraph 58 in Bhikkhu Bodhi's one. Purification comes about through some particular kind of rebirth, but it's not easy to find a kind of rebirth, and then the particular kind of abode. Okay, so these ones are very similar. The samsara sudhi, the idea here seems to be that the purification comes about through the actual process of samsara, and these other ones, the rebirth, upapatti, being one of the words for rebirth, upapatti, and the dwelling. These seems to mean that when you get into one particular kind of rebirth, that will be purify you for some reason. And the next one, some people say that through sacrifice, yanyena sudhi, you become purified through sacrifice. And the Buddha say, well, it's not easy to find a sacrifice that has not already been offered up by me in this long journey when I was either a head anointed noble king or a well-to-do Brahman. There are certain recluses and Brahmins whose view is this: the purification comes about through fire worshipping. Agi. Okay, here we go. It's not quite appearing there. Agi paricharyaya. Agi paricharyaya. Agi being the fire, paricharyaya being the fire worshipping. And of course, this being one of the great practices of the Vedic period was the worship of fire. So, but it is not easy to find a kind of fire that has not already been worshipped by me in this long journey, whether I was a head anointed noble king or a well-to-do Brahmin. There are certain recluses and Brahmins whose view and doctrine is this: as long as this good man is still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life, so long is he perfect in his lucid wisdom. But when this good man is old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life and come to the last stage, being 80, 90 or 100 years old, then the lucidity of his wisdom is lost. But it should not be regarded so. I am now old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and come to the last stage. My years have turned 80. So I mentioned before that the commentary says this sutta was given when he was 80. Of course, this being confirmed in the sutta itself. So right near the end of the Buddha's life. So it's interesting. That means that Sunakata's whole episode must have been in the last few years of the Buddha's life. And that even so, even though the Buddha was so well respected at that time, then he still was leaving him. Now, suppose that I had four disciples with 100 years lifespan, perfect in mindfulness, retentive memory, and lucidity of wisdom. So the words here, paramaya satya, I'm perfect in mindfulness, sati, hearing, also memory, close enough, retentiveness, gatiya, jadhitiya, and lucidity of wisdom here. Not quite sure about Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations here. Dhiti, whether dhiti actually means memory, I'm not quite sure. I would think that sati there means memory. Gati, retentiveness, it seems to translate them more or less as synonyms. I'm not sure if they quite are synonyms here. Gati is often, in this kind of context, explained as meaning something like the gati means the going. And so the gati would mean with regard to texts, it would be understanding the structure or the way that the texts go. Okay? That's how I think it would be more, generally understood. And dhiti would mean, something more like wisdom rather than memory. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I'm not quite confident in Bhikkhu Bodhi's renderings there. In any case, the general idea is clear enough. Just as a skilled archer, practiced, trained, and tested, could easily shoot a light arrow across the shadow of a palm tree. Okay, so you've got this great archer. He's not asked to do any great task. It's just a shadow of a palm tree. It's that much across. He's got to shoot an arrow across. That easily. Suppose that they're even to that extent perfect in mindfulness, retentive memory, and lucidity of wisdom. Okay, so that's how skilled the four disciples are. Now, suppose that they continuously ask me about the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas, and that I answered them whenever asked, and that they remembered every answer of mine and never asked a subsidiary question. Okay? So that means they never like repeated their questions. They kept asking new questions and so on. And they never paused except to eat, drink, consume food, taste, urinate, defecate, and the rest in order to remove sleep and rest in order to remove sleepiness and tiredness. Okay? Still, the Tathagata's exposition of the Dhamma, his explanations of factors of the Dhamma, and his replies to questions would not yet come to an end. But meanwhile, those four disciples of mine with their 100 years lifespan would have died at the end of those 100 years. Sariputta, even if you have to carry me about on a bed, still there will be no change in the lucidity of the Tathagata's wisdom. So here indeed is a great lion's roar about the nature of his wisdom. This particular very powerful passage dealing with the questioning regarding the four satipatthanas, I believe, is found as a sutta in and of itself in the Satipatthana Sanyutta. I don't think it's in the Pali, but I think in some of the other Sanyuttas, the Satipatthana Sanyutta, this particular simile is found as an independent sutta. So this is a very, again, very, very powerful claim by the Buddha. Four disciples, 100 years each. So skilled and tested, and they're going to keep on asking questions. And we just have the patience to be able to keep on answering them in all of these really annoying questions on and on and on, and never repeating himself for 400 years. Wow. Okay. Rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, a being not subject to delusion has appeared in the world for the welfare and happiness of many out of compassion for the world for the good welfare and happiness of gods and humans. It is of me indeed that, rightly speaking, this should be said. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Naga, so that's the end of the discourse as such, the Venerable Naga Samala was standing behind the Blessed One, fanning him. Then he said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvelous. As I listened to this discourse on the Dhamma, the hairs of my body stood up. Venerable Sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma?" As to that, Nagasamala, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the hair-raising discourse. And this is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Nagasamala was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, of course, the hair-raising discourse being the name, as Sister mentioned earlier, in some of the Chinese versions. Interesting to note that the Theravadan version, for some reason, is, even though the Buddha himself has given a title to the sutra, has chosen to remember it as a different name. I'm not quite sure why, but I always remember this particular sutta because the first time that I read it, as I was reading, I found that all of these discussions of the Buddha's powers and so on to be so powerful, as I came towards the end of it, had such piety and rapture that all my hair stood on end. And then I turned the page and then it said, as I was listening to this discourse, my hair stood on end. So it's very true, it can actually raise the hairs on you. So this is the hair-raising discourse. And any more questions? Comments about that?
Okay, the Buddha
is
supposed to
have done,
what,
5 years of sitting
practice? Something like that, yeah. So he would have had enough time to do that whole list.
I think so, yeah.
Or is he referring to past lives?
Oh, no, I think those practices are meant to be referring to this life, yeah.
It's quite a list, isn't it?
It is quite a list, yeah. It would have taken a while to work through them all. Yeah. I mean, some of them you can do simultaneously. But other ones you have to do one at a time. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't think of much else that you can add to that, is there?
Oh, no. I mean, the Indians have got this great sense of imagination regarding ascetic practices, so there's plenty of ones that are not there.
This one didn't go into his explaining his turning away from that, saying that.
Yeah.
I did say that it didn't lead to any higher distinction in knowledge.
Right.
It doesn't go understanding what happened.
It doesn't give the whole story, yeah. So the whole that story is given a bit later on, yeah. So it's interesting, just as a little aside, but it's interesting that there's several suttas. It's quite characteristic of the Majjhima Nikaya in Pali. There's several suttas that deal with these kinds of things, and not so much in the other Nikayas. And in the Chinese Majjhima Agama, none of those suttas dealing with the Buddha's practice of austerities are actually found in the Majjhima Agama. And so this led to some speculation, and obviously it's a bit of a worry. Does it mean that all of those suttas are late or inserted, or what happened to them? Why are they all gone? But that problem was solved when they discovered the Sanskrit Dirgha Agama from the same school, the Sarvastivadin school, and they found that all of those suttas, such as this one I think we have here, and the Arya Pariyasana Sutta and others, I think the Mahasachika Sutta and so on, they're all found in the Dirgha Agama of the Sarvastivadin. So that was merely a choice of where do we put them. They all had the same suttas, but some Sarvastivadins chose to put them in their Digha, and the Theravadins chose to put them in their Majjhima. Okay, very good. So that's any more questions?
Can you say anything about what happened to
To Sunakata? What happened to Sunakata? No.
And yet the Buddha was just about to pass away, he was 18 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, he might have died before Sunakata did. Quite likely, yeah. Yeah, the bit I read out before was from the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names, which has kind of assembled the traditions as well as the Sutta traditions, but also the later traditions on what actually happened to these people. And that often has a lot of poetic license in filling out the details of people's lives, but even in there it didn't seem to say anything about the later traditions. It seemed to say anything about how he ended up, but I think we're meant to he had this kind of persistent problems for many years and couldn't solve them while the Buddha was around, so I don't really fancy his chances too much. Okay, so
Sampanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṃ.